We're back.
We would have been back 5 seconds ago, but you just had to.
I know. I had to grab some water because I've been talking so much, man. You have to stay hydrated. Like I like. You can't see. You can only see two of the four cups that are over there by Corey. So he'll line them up for you and watch the number of cups just increase throughout the day. Mine's hidden back here.
It's a work in progress.
But this is the section we're going to be talking about virtualization, and you happen to know a little bit about virtualization.
I do, but my virtualization is limited to virtual PC.
Oh, we got the wrong person talking today. We're not talking about server virtualization from the old days. Remember, it was a downloadable product you had to buy?
I know.
Ooh. Ages ago.
And it ran in user context? How uncool.
Yeah, so anyway, that is far, far, far gone from where we are right now.
It is.
This is the section we're going to be talking about what's new in Server 2012 Preview, specifically server virtualization in Windows Server 2012 R2. Interesting question came up on the chat room already. It was about licensing. Currently, there are a couple of different editions of Windows Server 2012 and Windows Server 2012 R2.
And
those editions have not changed between the two of them.
No, they haven't. But the licensing models and all that kind of stuff did change from, well, I don't know if the licensing models, but what you get with the editions, did change from 2008 to 2012.
Right.
And a lot of people are just weren't really aware of it.
Yep.
Because we're used to, you know, standard enterprise data center, standard being, you know, like two procs, enterprise being four or whatever, and data center being, you know, as many as you want. And that's gone away, right?
Right. So technically speaking, the things you can do within standard are not limited in any way, shape, or form than what you can do in data center. There's no longer difference between the two of them. It's strictly a licensing difference between the two of them, and it's virtualization rights.
Yep.
If you have a standard edition of Server 2012 or Server 2012 R2, you have virtualization rights for two virtual instances on a single socket.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if you have a two-socket server, you can run two copies of standard edition on that, which license-wise, which would give you four instances to be able to go off and to run virtual machines on top of that.
Yep.
And then data center is licensed on a per socket basis, and it gives you unlimited virtualization rights of server products on top of that one there. And it is also licensed on a per socket basis. And there is a third version, which is called Hyper-V Server 2012, which has no virtualization rights, but it is free to purchase and to purchase. It's free to use, but you have to license all your guests through some other mechanism. So it's great for, obviously, for hosting environments where they use a SPLA license, where they simply pay for what's being used by their customers. They don't have to license the hypervisor. They simply use the Hyper-V Server 2012. Also great for educational environments and developer environments where they just want to have a virtualization platform they can use. Hyper-V Server, again, no functional differences for what you can do with it between virtualization, clustering, high availability, NIC teaming, all sort of stuff. There's the user interface is a core environment. It's not a GUI environment. And that particular one there is not able to do anything else besides virtualization.
Right,
you can't run directory services. You can't run the fax server on it. You can't run Active Directory. You can't run file and print services on that guy. It's just for virtualization.
There's nothing as soothing as the sound of a fax machine in the morning.
You got
squawk.
For those of you that still have it, have it.
Yeah. And for those of you that still have the skill to denote the baud rate by the squelch sounds.
Nice. Now you're dating yourself for sure.
I know.
There's also a edition that happens to be called the Essentials Edition, and we'll be talking about that in a bit tomorrow.
We are. We were going to show that this morning, but we got so carried away talking about this we forgot. So we'll show you that this morning, and we'll show you that tomorrow. That's all real cool stuff.
And then there's also an edition that happens to be called
Storage
Server, which basically is like a storage appliance. And we'll touch on that one there in the storage section.
It's an OEM thing.
Yeah.
There was a web server version at 1.2. That's gone away, right?
Gone.
Yeah, that's totally gone. And then, wasn't there a basic version, like a Windows Server?
Foundation?
Foundation, that was it. That's gone too.
That's
right?
OEM.
Yep, but that's OEM only. Okay.
Yep. So, virtualization,
now,
my friend.
Speaking of Hyper-V Server.
Okay.
You did mention one thing on the licensing of that. That's ideal for VDI. We'll talk about that when we get to the VDI section, but that's the perfect platform for VDI because you don't, like, if you're on data center and you put VDI on top of it, VDI is desktop OSs. The licensing for data center doesn't cover desktop operating systems, so you gain nothing by running data center. It's covered by, you know, VDA or one of the other licensing mechanisms for VDI. So Hyper-V Server is the ideal one for VDI.
Right. And you manage it remotely with RSAT, with SCVMM and others, as you would expect. So once again, If you're interested, additional resources available at MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com. You guys can read the slide, I'm sure, for being able to download a copy of it, mm-hmm. both for System Center and for Server 2012 R2. But for virtualization, we will be talking about the differences and changes that exist both in the scalability and performance area, and then we'll be breaking these into different sections for security, multi-tenancy, infrastructure, high availability, virtualization, and then basically everything to do about virtualization is inside this one section. And as you mentioned earlier, there is a number of sessions available on the Channel 9 site for TechEd, yeah. specifically around virtualization, that has a whole whack of different host of speakers you can go off and take a look at on demand anytime you want to at channel9.msdn.com.
Yeah, a lot of those sessions, you know, I've watched the bulk of them. Yeah. A lot of them are what I like to call firework shows. You know, it's like, you know, here's the really cool thing, bang, look how neat it is. And they bring in really heavy hardware, yeah. you know, four RDMA cards in a server, 20 yeah. servers in a cluster to show those real big scale up, you know, yes, we can do it scenarios. So if you want to see some of those big, you know, hey, look, let's look at a VM doing, you know, 1 million, 2 million IOPS. They've got all that stuff set up and running there. But, you know, it's at a little bit more higher level than we're going to kind of dive into. Because they've got so much to cover in such a short period of time. And we've made a point to not do what they're doing in a lot of these sessions, just to give you a little bit of a different perspective on it. So those recorded sessions from TechEd, from guys like, you know, Ben Armstrong, Jeff Woolsey, Eldon Christensen, that are, you know, they complement what we're doing very well. So highly recommend you take those as, you know, your homework, so
yes.
to speak.
Last couple of questions to wrap up licensing, because we didn't have a section specifically on it. Someone was asking, so is machine only and about user cals? You obviously have to have user cals to be able to go off and talk to these different servers. It's specific to the version. You do not need new, if you have 2012 cals, you do not need to have new R2 cals to be able to go off and talk to the server. You need the license change for the server to run 2012 or the server to run 2012 R2.
You're looking at me with licensing?
No, I know.
I'm willing to say SANs are dead. I'm not saying a peep about licensing. I'll get in trouble.
There you go. And then also, someone was also asking about the release date for Windows Server 2012 R2.
Yeah, there is one.
There is one, and the answer is when it's ready.
Yeah. So sometime in the next period of time.
Sometime in the next period of time when it's ready. That's all we're going to say.
Yeah.
That's all we know.
Honestly, we don't know. We're not just stalling.
So,
we don't know.
Windows Server 2012 preview, a little bit of a history with concepts. You know, we were joking earlier about Windows PC virtualization and PC side of things, and also the old Windows Server virtualization pieces that were there. On June 28th, we came out with Hyper-V, the concept of what it was with 2008.
That's June 2008, not 2008. June 28th.
That's what I said, 2008.
You said 28th.
Oh, 2008. And then Hyper-V Server 2008 was launched. That was that free version we were talking about. It's an ISO. You can go and download it. In case you're wondering, it's Microsoft.com/HVS for Hyper-V Server if you're interested. But on October 2009, that's when the 2008 R2 version of Hyper-V came out. And that's where we had live migration. That's where we had clustered shared volumes for high availability yeah. and the ability to go off and to do hot out of storage. We had some big performance yeah. and scalability
increases. For a lot of us that were out in the real world, so to speak,
yep.
This was the first time we took it seriously.
Interesting. I like that.
Yeah, I know. I may have just gotten myself fired, because of the features that came with it,
right?
That we went, okay, this is now a first-class citizen in the virtualization space. When
yep.
you put it alongside things like Xen and things like VMware, there was a lot of feature parity there, mm-hmm. whereas prior there wasn't.
I mean, it's in the industry, like any industry, it's always leapfrogging back and forth,
yeah.
right, between the different vendors. Now, a service pack came out, and that's when we added in dynamic memory
yep.
and also remote effects capabilities.
And so those two scenarios is where you took it seriously for VDI.
Yeah.
Because those two scenarios are what address the VDI scenario.
Consolidation story is a lot better with the dynamic
yep.
memory and also overall experience.
And also, like, dynamic memory in general is for clients. It's
yep.
not for servers. Now, you can put dynamic memory on servers, but if you're planning server capacity, like an Exchange or a SQL or a SharePoint server, you can work out down to the bit how much RAM you need for a given workload.
And then give it some headroom.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, point being that, like, you know, you're going to support an Exchange server with 400 users. There's calculators and guidance that you can go, for that you need this many IOPS, this much network bandwidth, and this much RAM.
Yeah, you're dating yourself again because...
So you don't...
That's how you build physical servers in the old days.
It's also how you do capacity planning for virtualization
you got
as
it.
Well. With VDI, you can't. Because the amount of RAM a given virtual desktop needs depends on what's hot on Facebook today,
mm-hmm.
whether everyone's watching a video or reading a text. And so That's where all the
much
shift
more variance going on.
The shift comes into play, and you're bringing a human factor into it.
Yep. Now, after that, we basically came out with Server 2012, and that was when, again, we did some massive amounts of changes for scalability and performance, where we have, as you'll see in a couple of slides, a huge amount of support for RAM, huge amount of support for disk size, and we have the ability to go through and do metering and quality of service, like a whole whack of different stuff that you should be familiar with. If you haven't checked out virtualization since 2008 R2, and you're on other platforms, you really need to seriously look at what we've done with 2012 and then amped it up even further with 2012 R2.
Yeah, it's the big thing with 2012 is mobility, where you can basically take a running VM and reconfigure it and move it and shift it and dice it and slice it without it ever going down.
Yep. Now, from a scalability and performance perspective, size-wise, the different things we can look at and the different capabilities you can go off and add into, this is actually kind of interesting little architecture slide I like to have that just talks about it. So basically, we've upped the amount of logical processors available on the host, and the amount of physical memory available on the host would then get carved up to provide to your guest machines, and up to a support of over 1,024 virtual machines per host because of the way we worked out the math for the logical processors versus virtual processors and stuff like that. So massive scalability on a single host that's out there. You then have the ability to scale out as far as your clusters are supported. In the past, it was only 16. Now it's four times that, up to 64, inside a single node of shared disk that people are going to go off and talk to from a virtualization perspective. Massive amount of changes, which also means that there's now support for support for 8,000 virtual machines inside this cluster environment. You can actually get those 8,000 virtual machines on less than the 64.
Oh, God, yes.
But it goes up to 64 from a performance perspective. Virtual machine-wise, each individual VM can support up to 64 virtual processors and can have up to a terabyte of memory. They also have up to, I forget even the limits of how big the VHDX files can get to from a file size perspective.
I don't even remember.
I think it's 64 terabytes as well for each individual file or something like that.
I think it might even be bigger than that.
It's crazy. But then you can have up to 200 and change SCSI connections on there.
As a guy that does this every day, these numbers are so high, I just don't care.
Right. We've gone from the perspective of now have no longer a unvirtualizable workload that's out there. Right? That's the term they use. Right?
No longer does the question come up, can I go big enough?
Yeah. So what you need to know from this is that there's no changes in scale from 2012 to 2012 R2. It's the same amount of scale that we had. We all support these ones here that were available in 2012. 2012 R2 just simply goes in and improves in other areas.
And honestly, there's no reason to go bigger because I've even run into scenarios with Hyper-V hosts I've built where we've got so much RAM and so much disk and so much memory that the bottleneck's now the PCI backplane.
Right.
I had one server that had 2 gig PCI bus, and we weren't able to push all the network data we wanted to because we're limited by PCI now.
Yeah.
When you get to that size of a scale, you start finding that things like RAM, you don't need nearly as much as you can get.
And I will put this out there that if anyone has access to a 4 terabyte machine and wants to loan it to either Corey or I, we will graciously accept it for a period of time to be able to go around and play with a system with that much memory.
Yeah, we just want to make one and just go, look.
4 terabytes.
Yeah. How many copies of Pinball can I run?
Now, this came up in Ben Armstrong's session at TechEd, North America and TechEd Europe, which I wasn't aware of at first because I didn't have a chance to play with it before TechEd. Is Gen 2 VMs.
Ooh,
and so we actually put this up here for Gen 2 VMs. The idea is that virtualization has been around for such a long time that we are trying to emulate old systems that have been around for a very, very long time. And there's a lot of extra baggage that isn't required in most modern operating systems these days. And so Gen 2 VMs basically now have a synthetic NIC. They have synthetic NICs before, but now they basically do away with the legacy NICs if you don't need them. You don't have to make a Gen 2 machine, by the way.
No.
Gen 1s and Gen 2s can coexist and they work just fine together. But if you're making a new machine through a creation wizard, you have the option of making it a Gen 1 or Gen 2. Gen 2 has the ability to have a Pixie boot directly off the synthetic NIC. It has the ability to hot add CD ROM drives in your system and DVD drives in your system. You can also go through and have support for UEFI BIOS firmware updates for your system to have a more secure boot environment if you wanted to. It also does a faster boot off of virtual SCSI with the ability to go through and dynamic resizing of disks, which we'll be showing a little bit later on for VHDX files. And then also from a security perspective, because it does support UEFI firmware boots, you can do a secure boot on that system and also have access to TPM stuff for removal of emulated devices and also with that more secure boot.
Let me show you a couple of cool things here.
Quick things on Gen 2 systems.
Quick things. I'm going to take my dead time. So real quick, just kind of the difference. As Rick said, when you go to create a new VM, new virtual machine wizard, you now have a specified generation option. You do this when you create the VM. After you create it, you can't change it. So it's a one time only. Gen 2 VMs are based on a UEFI setup, not a I think like ACPI or something, whatever the old BIOS standard was, the x86 BIOS standard. There's no BIOS on them that you boot into. It's all UEFI based. When they're created as a VM, it looks a little bit different. So here's a Gen 2 VM versus a Gen 1 VM. I'm just going to kind of stick these, side by side here. There we go. So here's a Gen 2 VM. You can see it's got, well, first of all, Gen 1, this is what you're used to looking at, BIOS, memory processor, IDE, controller with the four available IDE disks, so SCSI controller, and other stuff. This one here, you'll notice there's no BIOS, it's just firmware. How are you going to boot? And what are all the options that are available for me to boot? Processor's the same, and you don't have that IDE bus anymore. It's now just a SCSI bus.
Right.
So those are the things you see on the hardware side. Inside a Gen 2 VM, we'll come back to this little titty here in just a second. I'll show you what that's all about in just a second, because that's also kind of new and cool. So let me get the other Gen 1 VM up here as well.
Man, you got Windows like crazy, man. That's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
There we go.
All right. So we're just going to sign in here. We're broadcasting at 720p, so I'm limited by vertical.
Yeah.
So I apologize for that, but at any rate. So we look at a Gen 2 VM here. I'm just going to pull up essentially Disk Manager, or sorry, Device Manager. So this is, you know, one of the world's most boring demos. It's just Device Manager. But they are actually different.
They're coming. Where are they?
Well, I'm trying to get enough that I can actually see things here. So I'm letting Server Manager. I'm running these, by the way, in 512 gig of RAM. I got the RAM choked way down on them. that is on purpose.
You know, I'm just a Windows Key X myself guy.
Oh, is Device Manager in there?
Yeah, Device Manager's in there.
I didn't realize
Windows
that.
Windows Key X and choose Device Manager.
Oh, geez.
It's a lot
there
faster.
I know.
Than what you're trying to do with all these Windows.
Thank you, Rick.
There, we taught him something.
We've now
Windows Key X, man.
We've now justified your presence.
Nice, thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, so Device Manager, a little bit different. We're going to just go view device by connection here. And so you can see on the Gen 1 VM, it's a traditional PCI bus with an ISA bridge, and this is, you know, what you would see on a physical machine.
ISA bridge still, eh?
Yeah, I know.
I forgot about
on
that.
On a Gen 2 VM, it's a little bit different. So view by device by connection.
Yeah.
And you'll see that right off the bat, it's based on VM bus, and everything is based on VM bus. So it's a little bit of a more efficient architecture. Mm-hmm. The Gen 2 VMs, they install faster and they boot faster. They all run the same once they're up and running, but it's quicker to install and configure and deploy a Gen 2 VM. Right, so that's essentially, you know, what you see. It's a complete behind the scenes under the hood architecture that allows the next generation of VMs to be created. And in the past, the whole goal with VMs was to make it the equivalent of a physical machine. Now we've accepted the fact that VMs are first class citizens. So now a VM can know it's a VM and can take advantage of all the benefits of being a VM. And that's where the whole notion behind a Gen 2 VM comes from.
OS supported inside Gen 2s?
Only Windows 8 and 2012 R2. Windows and 64-bit. Windows 8, 64-bit and later, and 2008 R, 2012 R2 and later, which is only 64-bit. And so going back to one other little kind of neat sort of thing in here, close Server Manager. When I fired up my Gen 2 VM, it gave me a little bit of an interesting prompt, you might have noticed. VM Connect's been redone. Mm-hmm. And so for you guys that are administrators that want to go in and fix and troubleshoot and configure and build VMs, you now get a full-fledged RDP experience through VM Connect, whether or not you actually have a network connection. So it doesn't go through the TCP/IP stack. It goes through VMBus to give you what is essentially the equivalent of RDP. Now, to get this, there's two things you got to do. On the Hyper-V host settings, you've got to turn on enhanced session mode.
Right.
And then there's a session mode policy which allows it. Right. So you got to turn it on, you got to allow it. The second thing you've got to do is on the VM itself, under the integration services, turn on guest services. So this one's off by default. And with that one turned off, you get your traditional VM Connect session. With this one turned on, it's enabled for the new generation of VM Connect. And this works on I think it's, actually, I shouldn't state the OS requirement for it because I don't know it offhand. I believe it's 8 or later.
It's 8 or later.
And I think if you update the additions in Win 7, it will also do it as well, but I need to verify that. I came across that somewhere. But it's preview, it may change. And so what happens then is when I go to my Gen 2 VM, it's basically an RDP prompt. Mm-hmm. Show options, local resources, audio, video.
Yep.
And then redirection of printers, clipboard, drives, and plug-and-play devices, including things you plug in later. So you now can actually redirect a USB device into a VM.
Yep.
So we hit OK on that, connect on that. And so now I'm logging on.
And again, this is just the connection manager you're using. It's not an RDP solution.
No, this is the connection manager. I mean, I could take the network card and disconnect it if I wanted to. It would still work. I don't need to necessarily do that. But what it also gives me is copy-paste right into a VM through the console.
Nice.
All right.
That's brilliant.
So
love it.
That's, you know, it's not a big architectural thing, but boy, does it make our lives easier.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Now, one thing that you didn't talk about, but we alluded to earlier, was a new form of file format of VHDX files. Those existed with 2012.
They existed
with 2012 R2.
They sure did.
And we've got a slide specifically on this guy here with the idea behind the VHDX file. It gives you increased scale as far as size is concerned for what's now available inside it. Generally, the VHD file was limited to 2 gigabytes. This guy now can go up significantly larger, up to 64 terabytes in storage with a single VHDX file if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gives you better protection from corruption of power failures because it logs updates to the metadata structures of the VHD file. And if it notices that there was a problem with a power outage or something that happened, they get a chance to write to it. It's able to go and replay that corrupted entry because the metadata has that information for what should have happened to that particular VHDX file. So very, very important to have that one there. You have the increased storage capacity. You have the ability to go through and obviously protect your data from corruption. And then also, it has a better mapping for large sector disks to be able to have those larger disks more efficiently used without a performance hit of doing translation down to the 512.
And you can convert from VHD to VHDX.
Right.
You can convert from VHDX to VHD as long as it's not too big.
Mm-hmm.
Simple, straightforward to do. You can do it through PowerShell or you can do it through the UI. And when you create a VHD or create a VM and you're specifying it, look down on the screen real quick. That's a VM. I create a new VHD. You just choose the type.
Yep.
So 64 terabytes, you raise right there in the UI.
Yep. Now, one thing that's really neat with VHDX file is the fact that you now have the ability to go through and do resizing.
You can.
And so you basically are an example here. We have a VHDX online resize, provided you're attached with a SCSI environment, with SCSI disk. It can't be IDE. It does not need to be Gen 1 or Gen 2. It's either one of those
right.
two will work. Basically, you can go through and grow your VHD and VHDX files whilst you are attached to a running virtual machine. You can tell Ben Armstrong made this slide deck, eh? Because it says whilst. And then you can go through and basically expand it, and then go through and expand that volume, and then come back again. The expanded volume basically is now visible within the guest. It does it without any downtime. You can also go through and shrink those disks as well to reclaim those sizes. And it will actually shrink the size of the VHD file, a VHDX file, whilst it is running as well. So, do you have a quick little demo on that one there?
Yeah, absolutely. We can show a couple of things in here real quick.
Now, the requirements are VHDX, and it also has to be an iSCSI, a SCSI attached.
A SCSI attached disk controller. So
inside the controller of the VM.
I've now dropped my screen resolution to 640 by 480. Mm. And so what I'm going to grab is Disk Manager. Then I'm gonna
also in WinX as well, buddy.
It is.
WinSCSI X.
I never use this.
I use it all the time, man.
Disk management. There it is right there. Look at that. So let's kind of take a look at what happens with this resize. So we're going to go up here, view.
So you have a disk one that's there, and you're going to go with scale? Oh, okay, according to capacity.
And use linear scaling.
Okay.
Right, so basically it shows it, you know, as a real sort of comparison. And so what we're going to do in here is take this VM, and we're going to add a new VHD to it. This is all while the VM's running, obviously. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go to my SCSI controller, add a new hard drive. New hard disk. It's going to be a VHDX hard disk. Dynamically expanding is fine. And we're going to put this, call this one new VHDX. And we're just going to put it in just a simple VM store folder.
Yeah.
127 gig is fine. Next, finish. And hit OK. And we'll hit apply. And you'll see pretty much right away over here.
A new disk has been added into the existing machine.
Right. And so we can actually take that disk. Now we go 127 gigs. Geez, I really need that to be 100 gigs. So we can just edit it. Expand it. And let's make it 1,000 gigs. Make it a terabyte in size.
Nice.
So hit next a couple of times. Hit finish. I'm going to come over here and I'm just going to do a rescan. There it is.
And now it is significantly larger. Now and your other one shrunk because it's in perspective mode, right?
Yeah, it didn't actually get smaller. It just looks like it got smaller.
Thanks.
So now it's 1,000 gigs. So what I can do now is I can trade into a shrink. You can't straight away shrink this, okay? Because the shrinking has to take into consideration that you might actually have user data on there.
Right.
And if you have user data on there and you just shrink it, you truncate stuff. If I just try and run a shrink on this now, I'll get an error saying there might be user data, you can't truncate it. So you've got to put it into a state where there's a clear amount of space where we know there's no user data.
Right.
And so the sequence by that this would typically happen is I'm going to bring this online and initialize it. And so essentially, you know, you wouldn't create a disk and shrink a disk. You'd create a disk and you'd put a bunch of user data on it by creating a volume and putting a bunch of user data on a volume. So we're going to create a volume on here. It's going to be a full-size volume, eDrive, NTFS, quick format. That's all fine and good. Finish and give that a second to kind of finish up. And
pretty so simple now, stuff. Yeah,
so we got an eDrive now. And so what we would have discovered is that, oh, people deleted all their data. And so step one is I would need to reclaim some space off eDrive. And so I delete everything and I'd shrink my eDrive. And you'll see eDrive can actually shrink quite a bit because, well,
there's no data on it.
There's right no now. Data on it. And it's shrunk so small,
you can't even see it, actually.
So what that allows me to do now is run a compact on my VHD file. I'm going to do this one through PowerShell to show you the command in PowerShell. Get out of there. So let's grab PowerShell. I'm going to slide this over here a little bit. And we'll just go make it shrink. It is resize.
Yep.
VHD. And so new VHD, and we'll take a size. We'll just go to minimum size. And we'll just run that command. So now we'll come back in here and do a rescan.
So originally it was created and it was set up to be a terabyte in size. Yep. Or 128 gig and then a terabyte.
Yeah.
And so now it's shrunk down again to 3 gigabytes. Right.
3 gigs in size. So you can see kind of what happened there. And again, the flow behind this is added a disk. Disk wasn't big enough. You know, added a disk, added a partition. Partition filled up, made the disk bigger. Filled up the disk, partition got all the data deleted, shrunk the partition. Now, because I've shrunk the partition, I know definitively there's a chunk of that disk that's raw with no data.
Yeah.
Because I've shrunk the partition. You can't shrink a raw disk that's never had a partition because there are some file systems that will put data on a raw disk. And it doesn't know that, so it assumes that there's something there. It plays it safe. The last thing you want to do is run a shrink and delete user data.
You got it.
So using this process, while the VM's up and running, you can expand, you can contract. The contract involves shrinking the volume, shrinking the user data, creating that clear space, then dropping the size of the VHD down. Now, because I'm using a dynamic size VHD, the file size on disk didn't change in any of this. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the point. It could certainly do it with if I did a fixed size VHD, the file size would have actually done this as well.
Yep.
in POCA.
I think you got it right with the visualization in there anyway. So just so you know, Windows Key X, a lot of stuff in there.
I never use it.
The next section is about ODX, offloaded data transfer. And this is something that's not specifically unique to virtualization, other than the fact that it can now leverage this, because this is more on the storage side of things. But we thought we'd bring it up in here as well for what ODX is. Now, this is assuming that you're using a SAN environment that supports ODX transfer inside of it. And the idea is that you're going to be moving a chunk of data, like a VHD file or a virtual machine, from number one to number two. In the system, as opposed to having to go through and use a copy process from one, copy it down locally in memory and then over the other guy. Instead, you're going to be using a token-based approach. By basically, the server goes in and does a regular copy through Explorer, through PowerShell, through GUI interface, or through whatever interface you want to have. Mm-hmm. It says, copy this one file over there. The OS is going to go in and basically, it knows that it's talking to an ODX-supported SAN environment. It then is able to go in and say, there's my actual data I need to go off and do a copy with. It's going to basically drop off a token and say, yeah, this is the data that's going to be transferred over and you're authorized to do because you're the sender of it. Transfer that token across the wire over the network to the second guy, which then goes in and uses that token to talk to the same SAN and then does the actual data transfer in the SAN level, which basically means massive amounts of throughput and copy process goes through because the data doesn't actually leave the SAN. It now, instead of going down the network wire and across back up again, it's just simply done at the SAN level.
Yep.
Very simple stuff. Yeah, it's now supported. It was there in 2012. It's there in 2012 R2. It's not changed.
If you're doing things like cloning of VMs and replication and stuff, this makes it a lot quicker to do.
Yep. Virtual fiber channel is something that was available and is here in 2012 R2. And the idea is basically the ability to go through and have a fiber channel virtual HBA card inside your virtual machine that is able to go off and to move to the other virtual machine.
Is it inappropriate for me to even talk about this now after what I said before?
I don't know, man. You're going to need to explain this a bit more because you've got a fiber channel.
I have a huge investment in fiber channel that I can't wait to retire.
Right.
So virtual fiber channel, keep in mind, you've got guest clustering and you've got host clustering, right? And virtual fiber channel was designed for kind of two scenarios. One is to better enable guest clustering. And by guest clustering, I mean you have two VMs that are members of a cluster that are on a Hyper-V server as opposed to two Hyper-V servers that are members of a cluster that contain a VM. In order to create a guest cluster, or any kind of cluster, you need some element of shared storage. And the only option in Hyper-V in 2008 R2 was iSCSI. Mm-hmm. There's two options, three options in 2012, or four options in 2012, holy smokes. You've got virtual fiber channel, you've got shared VHD, which we'll talk about, got iSCSI, and you've got file server. But what fiber channel allows you to do is allows you to basically connect an HBA and a physical fiber channel SAN to a virtual machine. And then you can live migrate that virtual machine to other Hyper-V hosts, and assuming the fiber channel cards and SAN are compatible, there's a set of specifications they've got to meet, which are listed on the interweb, and I don't know what they are off the top of my head, but they're there. There's a list of approved certified fiber channel cards. Mm-hmm. Assuming you have those, then you can live migrate from one host to another, one cluster node to another, and the fiber channel connection will move with it.
Right.
And there's two things that you do within the VM to configure virtual fiber channel. I don't have any fiber channel in this environment. That'd be blasphemy compared as far as I'm concerned. But if I go on a VM and I go settings, you can add a fiber channel HBA. You just need a VM that's powered off. Let's gracefully turn off this one.
Oh,
bang.
Nice.
And we go settings, and we go add hardware, fiber channel adapter, add. There's a fiber channel adapter.
Right.
And now it wants a virtual SAN, which I'll show you in just a second. You then configure, and for those of you guys that are used to doing fiber channel, the worldwide names, the port names, and you know all about this stuff. This is what you do for LUN masking, what you do for zoning and your switches and all those sort of tasks. On the Hyper-V host, you create a virtual SAN. The virtual SAN has a range of worldwide names, which is like the MAC range for TCP/IP, and then you simply create the SAN. Once the SAN is created, you can now connect, and it uses the fiber channel adapters in the host, using the worldwide names to connect those fiber channel paths right directly through to the VM. So on that VM, because I created a SAN with a generically useless name, where'd my fiber channel controller go?
Nice.
Did I? I did not hit OK.
You didn't actually hit OK on the fiber channel.
So here's the fiber channel SAN. I can edit the addresses on it. And you just kind of go from there.
So from a live migration perspective, it actually uses and makes sure that the data is going through one of those worldwide names. And
right.
then when it does the live migration piece, it uses the other worldwide name on the same virtual machine to have access to it. And then when the live migration is complete, it then basically turns off one.
Right.
It goes on.
And you get all the features of FiberChannel. You get multipath if you put under two HPAs in there. All those things work. It's
yep.
full-fledged FiberChannel. So if you're doing, for example, Exchange clustering on Hyper-V, that typically the way that it will be done, it will be through guest clustering because
yep.
Exchange does an active cluster model, just like SQL does. And so you, in order to do that, you need to present shared storage. And so if you're clustering Exchange on Hyper-V, this is a way that you can present super fast fiber channel storage directly into the VM so you can build those guest clusters and still move the nodes between physical clusters without any downtime. So,
mm-hmm.
And also in VMM, by the way, supports all of this as well.
Yes.
So if we look at Virtual Machine Manager real quick, within Virtual Machine Manager, within your fabric area, you have the ability to define fiber channel fabrics,
mm-hmm.
and it's a broader picture that you can deploy across
multiple
hosts. And allows you to directly add the SANs themselves,
mm-hmm.
providing the SANs support the appropriate protocols like SMIS.
Yep.
It can also discover the SAN if the SAN, for example, has a management agent. Like, for example, some fiber channel SAMs like the HP or Dell or Echologic or NetApp, they can install agent software on a Windows server. And you can then tell VMM, you can manage the SAN via this management endpoint on a Windows server, which
mm-hmm.
is where this Windows-based file server component comes from. And then with VMM, it can actually go one step further, and it can actually do the SAN work for you. It can create the LUN, create the host mappings, potentially, I don't think directly, but work with the switches as well, and then configure the VMs to talk to those fiber channel adapters. So it becomes as simple as you going in VMM. This VM needs a LAN on that SAN via fiber, and it'll do it all for you.
Mm-hmm. We've already covered dynamic memory in a previous section, but just again as a brief little bit of a recap, in case you're only watching this section and you didn't see the previous section, it was introduced in 2008 R2 Service Pack 1, and the way that it's evolved in 2012 and 2012 R2 is you now have obviously the ability to go through minimum and startup memory requirements. Smart paging can be involved if you have a contention of amount of RAM available on your hosts just for the startup of a new system. It can temporarily use paging file space just for the startup and then balances itself out later. You then also have the ability to memory balloon systems up and down within your minimum and maximums, and the host OS does that. And then finally, the runtime configuration to be able to make any sort of changes. So that sort of stuff has already been used. Memory in use kind of goes up and goes down within the minimum and maximums. The administrators can basically increase the maximums of memory without a restart on the system while it's running. Smart paging, as I mentioned, is only used if you're trying to cycle a VM or reboot a VM and there's not enough startup RAM available for that particular guy when you've defined him. Performance is slightly degraded on that particular VM as it boots because it's obviously using the page file to be able to do it. But while it's in operation, it then reclaims that space and gets the memory that it was previously paged out from other systems to be able to go up and basically flush the pages out. This is not something that's able to be used by a VM as it's already running. Smart paging is only used to be able to start up a VM that's on the system. That's there. And then the resource metering is something that is a good tieback in the 2012 and 2012 R2, where basically you're able to go through and track virtual machine use on a more granular basis with how much CPU is in use, how much memory is in use, minimums and maximums, incoming and outgoing traffic, incoming and outgoing IOPS. All that sort of stuff can be tracked and available now, which then gives the ability to go into things and look at how to create chargebacks and how to create lookbacks on what kind of resources your individual VM sets are using. In this case, you've got a two-tenant environment with Hyper-V and Server 2012 preview. You've got different VMs that are consuming different amounts of memory. They have so much internet use being used as far as incoming and outbound traffic. In this case, the orange guy happens to consume more outbound traffic, whereas the internal resources for CPU, RAM, and processor on the blue side happens to be higher. You can basically now go through and expose this and adjust this for your billing purposes and also through different performance metering and performance measurement that's out there. Quality of service is now available for storage, where basically you can go through and set a maximum IOPS cap on a per machine basis. It also is able to go through to be done on a VHDX file by VHDX basis, so you can have different IOPS maximums for OS, different IOPS maximums for data volumes, that sort of stuff. That's out there.
You said that very casually for something that's this big a deal.
Which one?
This
particular part?
Storage quality of service.
Well, it is a QoS, quality of service that's out there.
So
but you can do it on a per disk basis.
It's right. So Hyper-V could never do this.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't go in and throttle disk. And this was a thing that cloud providers kind of had to try to deal with.
If you had a noisy neighbor on the same host,
right,
then it would be consuming too many IOPS.
And so have a look down at my screen for a second. So what I've got here is a VM that's running Iometer. And I'm running basically an 8K workload, an 8K read-write workload. And so we're getting about 230, 250, 250 IOPS out of this particular, 8K IOPS out of this particular VM. What I can do with it is under the settings of the VM, under the settings of the hard drive for the VM, this guy's only got one hard drive, under advanced, enable QoS on the hard drive. And this is based on an 8K increment. So regardless of what your actual block size is, and you've got to be aware of this when you're figuring this out, right? If you're running a 4K block size, or your I/O workload's running a 4K block size, you kind of want to double what your expectations are, or I should say cut it in half, because, you know, 1,000 4K IOPS is basically 500 8K IOPS.
Right.
So you've got to take your actual physical IOPS size into consideration. But I can take this, for example, and just say, you know what, I don't like you much, we're going to give you 20 IOPS. Hit apply on that, and you'll see that this will start to immediately drop down.
Oh, yeah.
And so that came down pretty hard and pretty fast and levels out right at around 20.
This is completely transparent to the guest that's running.
Right. All that happens is their IO response time kind of goes up.
Right.
So as far as they're concerned, the disks just got slower.
But it's no longer impacting other VMs on the same host.
Exactly right. Just like network QoS or CPU throttling, which you already have, we now have the ability to do disk throttling. And if I just remove that, you'll see it'll, you know, pretty rapidly go, hey, there's disk bandwidth.
Yeah.
You know, and as you make massive investments in storage and you look at, okay, I'm now in an SSD-based storage model, well, you don't want one guy that's running this real heavy disk workload just consume everything. Because, you know, when in a virtualized environment, all I/O is random, and you don't really know where it comes from. You just process it down at the storage layer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you can make sure that, you know, one guy can overconsume everything.
Yep.
Personally, I just about jumped for joy. I think the first screenshot of R2 I sent to my team was this right here. And I said, look, we've been waiting for this. Thank God we've got it.
So nice. And it's on a pretty, per VHD basis. So the OS per, VHD, yep, and data VHD.
Right.
If you had multiple VHDs.
Exactly. You set it per VHD. And so you do a little bit of obviously capacity planning with customers.
Yeah.
And but now you can go, hey, you know, you can have a gold VHD with 200 IOPS, you can have a silver with 150, or a bronze with 40.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sell into, whether it's within your org or outside as a provider, you can now sell those storage thresholds as services. Just
mm-hmm.
like you can do with network or you know, everyone's used to buying a 20 meg network line and paying more for a 100 meg network line. Well, same thing with storage now.
Now, we got a couple of questions that come in here an awful lot that are, you know, you're showing some stuff through the UI. Anything you're doing, in case it's not clear, anything you're doing through
yes.
the UI can be done through
yes,
the command
you can do
line
it in PowerShell.
With PowerShell.
Yes.
So, yes, you can do this through
whatever
PowerShell.
You see, if you're about to ask, can I do it in PowerShell, just
the
don't
yes.
bother.
Yes,
the
answer's yes.
You can do it in PowerShell.
You got it. From a security multi-tenancy perspective, we talked about just a little bit on the scale perspective. Security multi-tenancy, the first area that we're going to be talking about, just very briefly, I don't think we're going to be showing this, is the fact that you're able to obviously go off and segregate traffic with VLANs. This isn't new. This was available in 2012. And the idea is that basically if you have a primary VLAN and then secondary VLANs that are associated with the system, they can be set up in what's known as isolated mode, in which case they have to go down and talk to the appropriate lower level of the stack and the switch to be able to go off and talk to these two guys in blue because they're set up in isolated mode. So even though they're sharing the same VLAN, they can't talk directly to each other. They have to go through the network stack to be able to go
yep.
and do it. These guys over here are set up in what's known as community mode, in which case they are able to go off and talk to each other because they have the same secondary VLAN, the five, but they can't go off and talk to the other guys, which are over on the same primary VLAN of number two. And then finally, you have a guy that's in promiscuous mode, which can basically go off and talk to any of those guys as required because he shares the same primary and also the secondary. So basically, the secondaries are ignored
yep.
For what's there. So that's their That was available before, and it just simply talks.
And you'll never go configure it. VMM will do it for you.
Right, VMM does this.
And you won't even know you're doing it. You'll just configure a network topology in VMM, and it'll use this as an implementation.
Yeah. Now again, these guys are all in the same host in this particular case, right? But they could be on separate hosts.
Absolutely. So.
BitLocker is something that's available as well. Supports for based for disk space that's available that can now be encrypted as far as the system is concerned. It integrates with the TPM chip. It also is able to go through and can have the BitLocker keys stored with an Active Directory and have Active Directory integration. You can do BitLocker with VHD files that are on direct attached storage local to the box. You can also go through and do it on a traditional LUN off of an existing SAN that's out there. On a particular system. You can also go through and do it on a clustered shared volume that's out there as well. And then finally, you can do it on a shared VHDX file that happens to be on a file server with an SMB3 share. So basically, BitLocker is supported in all the different scenarios that are out there as a way of protecting your data on the system. Because obviously, if it's BitLockered, it's encrypted. You can't see what the data is unless you're the OS that has authorization to see it. From an infrastructure perspective, this is where we start talking about, obviously, support for different guests, but then also some of the new stuff. Now, the big thing that we have as far as Linux support, we had Linux support before. The difference is now it's considered to be even more of a first-class citizen that's out there because it now is supported on the ability to do dynamic memory, virtual CPU support up to 64. You have the ability to go through and do virtual SCSI, hot add, and online of memory and resources and resizing. You have full dynamic memory support. It also now would be supporting, which is kind of interesting, volume snapshots as well on those systems because of the enhancements or enlightenments that are part of the Linux kernel. And then finally, deeper integration and services support besides just simply mouse, keyboard, and time sync. So first-class citizen there for about 86% of the different distros that are out there, all the common ones you expect to see.
Yeah, and it's a big deal for guys that run Linux to know that, you know, they don't take a penalty for putting it on Hyper-V and how much that Microsoft is embracing the Linux community because there are all, you know, what Windows is quickly moving to become is the platform for the fabric, right? It's what you run the data center on. And there are so many hosters out there that, you know, have web solutions and websites and whatnot that are built on versions of Linux. You know, arguably far more than are built on IIS, because this has traditionally been, you know, some public website provider.com. They're all built in some variation of Linux. And knowing you can now virtualize all those, get rid of all those legacy Linux servers, drop them inside VMs, get all the mobility, get the backup, get the snapshot, get everything. I mean, it's great news.
Virtual machine live cloning. That's an interesting one. The ability to go through and basically do an export of a running VM.
This one, it doesn't get me all excited, but it's cool.
Not like the IO meter.
No. I start babbling and going whenever I see that. But with this, it's like okay, whatever. But essentially, the scenario is: hey, you know, I'm running a workload, and like maybe it's a SQL server, and all of a sudden, like. The thing throws an error, and you try to log on. It says you can't log on, and just something's bad. But the apps are all running. People are still getting data, and you're left in that kind of predicament of:
Do I take it down and try to troubleshoot it, or do I leave it as it is?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, do I leave it alone and go? Maybe it'll be fine forever. Because I've seen that happen. It's like, you know, when did the server break? Oh, a couple of weeks ago. Didn't you fix it? Nah, I didn't need to. Everything still works. Then is it broken?
Yeah.
But what you can do is with that running VM, and you just do this through VMM, is you can take the thing, you can right-click it, and you can clone it. If it's an online VM, it'll grab a save state. Now, you want to be careful about, you know, when you clone it and you target it at a point to clone it to, you want to be cognizant of, like, networks and things like that.
Yeah, you don't want to have it brought up in the same network in the same
production environment. Exactly, because now you've got IP conflict, you've got name conflict, all sorts of weird stuff. Or you can clone it up to the library and deploy it from there. Right. But bottom line is you can take a running VM and basically make an export of it and import it somewhere else and fix it, work on it, you know, do whatever those things are you need to do to it. So
that's now supported with Virtual Machine Live cloning. And it's basically through Virtual Machine Manager to be able to go off and to do that as the easy way of doing it. Now, we've covered live migration a lot. At least it should not be anything new for people for being able to see live migration stuff. Now, this live migration is the traditional way that you've done it as far as 2008 or 2 capabilities were there, where it has shared storage.
Before you jump too forward, jump on my screen for 1 second. Promise 2 seconds, that's it. Right click, create, clone, done. That's how you do the cloning in VMM. So
easy.
Yeah, just wanted to point to that. That's
okay.
All.
Okay, good to know. With live migration, the traditional way that you would see this with the first incarnation was that you had shared storage that was either iSCSI fiber channel or SMB storage with SMB3. And then you'd go through and be able to do a clone. Certainly not a clone, a live migration. The other side, I apologize for that one there. The live migration basically is going to go through and make a connection, go off and do the configuration data as you saw before, brings over the memory content, and then brings over changed pages, and then drops the connection and picks it up on the other side. The actual data itself of the machine stays where it was on that shared storage, and it's nice and fast, and it's basically all done. You can do, obviously, simultaneous migration at the same time. Now, if you do this new way of doing stuff with 2012 R2, we have this thing that's called compression that's built into it that basically accelerates the speed and speeds things up to go through and to use the host CPU resources to be able to do it. So you've still got that shared storage in the back end. You've got that connection of IP between the two different systems. Configuration data comes across, but then the actual amount of memory pages get shrunk and then brought across and then expanded back up to the side as far as the memory is concerned. And then the same thing goes across for modified memory pages and brings it across and comes up. This can dramatically speed up the process of doing a live migration and therefore allow you to do more migrations across, provided you got CPU overhead. Because as you mentioned, CPU is not the constraint area these days anymore on virtualization. It's actually other areas that are the constraining areas for things. Compressed memory goes across. The operates in the network goes across just fine. Generally, it can be like a 2x improvement in performance for migration is what we've seen in our initial tests.
So, you know, in the past, it was 100% TCP/IP based.
Right.
And now you've got choices. You can do standard TCP/IP, you can do compression, or you can use SMB. Do you have a slide on SMB?
I do. That's okay. Coming up right next.
All right. Well, I'll save
that. The idea is that, not SMB, you mean RDMA?
We mean the same thing.
I know.
Proceed.
So live migration compression, the good thing to note, it's the default way of moving things now when you're doing a migration between the two different things. It's going to, by default, use compression in the settings of the virtual machines that are, in the settings of the hosts that are set up to be able to work with Hyper-V on 2012 R2. Now, live migration over RDMA, basically you have, now things are offloaded to the network cards to be able to do the work. And this is dramatically faster between the two different systems.
Now, we haven't talked about what RDMA is, and we're going to do that in the storage section. So people understand what SMB Direct is and what RDMA is. But essentially, if you go jump on my screen for 1 second, all I've done here is pulled up the properties of a VM in Hyper-V, and you get the exact same thing if you pull up the properties of Hyper-V just on a host live migrations. Here's your choices, right? Advanced features, TCP/IP compression or SMB, and VMM gives you the exact same choices. It's a replication of everything. But if you choose SMB, it's going to use basically the server message block file share protocol instead of TCP/IP to do the live migration. The benefit you gain from doing this is if you have RDMA capable NICs, if you have RSS enabled, you get the offload capability of those. And that is going to be substantially faster, because what RDMA fundamentally does is removes the IP from TCP/IP, removes the TCP/IP from TCP/IP and just goes directly to memory. So you lose all the overhead of the TCP/IP protocol, and it becomes similar to a DMA transfer within a system, and really just runs at memory speeds. It copies it directly from memory to memory, bypassing the entire protocol stack. We'll talk more about that in the storage section, but if you want that super, super, super fast live migration, RDMA-capable NICs, SMB-based live migration, and it'll go over there so fast, the server will move 6 inches away.
Nice. Now, be aware, you mentioned that RDMA-capable NICs. Which ones are RDMA-capable that are out there? That was a question that came up in the chat room. It's like, talk to your manufacturer and find out.
But you know, the ones that I'm most familiar with are the Mellanox InfiniBand adapters, which are RDMA capable. So,
storage live migration, the ability to go through and basically move the backend storage of what things happen to be. There's simply VHD files. You got a host that's running Hyper-V. You got disk contents are basically copied over through a variety of mechanisms, whatever your choice happens to be, to that other destination that happens to be out there for the target device. You then start doing mirror disk writes across the system, because again, that Hyper-V host and that virtual guest is currently running. And then when it's ready to make that cutover, basically it makes that cutover and reattaches the file handles on the other side, again, without any downtime on the actual system itself. And this is obviously available through PowerShell or through a GUI interface. People go off and do that move that's out there.
Have a look on my screen for a sec. So again, just as kind of reiterating what Rick had said, if you take any running VM, you just have this move option on it. And again, mm-hmm. this was there in 2012, so nothing big news. So we're not going to go do anything elaborate here. Move type, move the storage, move all the storage,
the
move just
spot,
the data, or move just the VHDs.
Yep.
And I can say, well, here's the VHDs that I found that are associated with this VM. Where do you want to put them? And you can notice I can go different folders for different VHDs. And so I'm not going to finish all this and move them around, but the thing you got to keep in mind with this is when it comes back to the mobility, you know, you're running a VM on one SAN, you determine that this VM needs more I/O than that storage point can handle, you bring a faster one online, how do you get it from the slower one to the faster one without downtime? This is how you do it,
mm-hmm.
right? You just move it and the VM stays running.
Right.
This is how you move from a local machine to a file share. This is how you move from a clustered storage location non-clustered to a clustered storage location.
Mm-hmm.
So all those scenarios you can think of how you go from build to test to production to highly available to super highly available to super highly available and fast. Out in the downtime is just move the files around. So there you go.
We've talked about shared nothing live migration a couple of different times. That one there basically just goes through, again, regardless of where the destination of the source happens to be for the source VHD file. It goes across. It then goes and duplicates the contents in the target destination where it happens to go. It then goes in and does mirror writes between the two of them to make sure that all outstanding changes have been replicated. And then the actual memory content goes across, and then memory changed pages goes across as well. And then finally, it goes off and does the initial move, done, cut over, and you now have it on the destination Hyper-V box. It's up and running. Simultaneously, live migrate VMs and virtual disks between your hosts. Nothing is shared except for Ethernet cable. Though it's not supported, I have seen it even done over wireless connections between two boxes that are demo for uh-huh. laptops. You know,
here, catch my VM.
Yeah, catch my VM over the air if you wanted to.
We did that in a class I taught one time where I said, okay, here's your challenge. No cables. I want you to live migrate a VM through the air.
Right.
And they did it.
Again, it's not supported wireless on a server, but it is available as you put all the
yeah, but,
pieces
in. Yeah, but, where's the fun in that?
Yeah,
look on my screen real quick. Someone asked a question. Hey, is this live cloning stuff, is it SCVMM only? No, I'm exporting a running VM.
Yeah.
You can do that, and there's no drama.
Oh, yeah, it's under status, you can see there is exporting
yeah.
before.
So I'm exporting a running VM.
Yeah. And in case you haven't tried it as of yet, when you import that VM, if it's missing pieces or if it can't associate the proper disks, there's a wizard interface that now is able to walk you
yeah,
through.
Yeah, 2012 greatly cleaned up the import-export experience.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, in the past, if you didn't have all the VHDs and everything in the right place, export would just go, ha, 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 nice try, come
die
back tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now it'll go, hey, you're missing stuff, where is it?
Mm-hmm.
And reconstruct
it.
And that's because they've done, for those of you that are writing code against Hyper-V, mm-hmm. Like me, they've got a new WMI provider, which is a V2 a virtualization namespace, and they've got some new WMI methods and objects that expose some of these new functions
yep.
that have gotten better in R2 because I filed some bugs against them.
Nice. Now, this is an interesting one over here. Take a look at this. This is a simplified upgrade process for doing live migration.
So this is what we were talking about earlier.
We alluded to this in the first session, so here we're going to go into more detail about it. The idea about taking your 2012 Hyper-V environments, standalone and or clustered. In this case, we're showing an example of a clustered environment. To be able to move and do an upgrade from 2012 Hyper-V to 2012 R2 preview or final RTM when it goes final with no VM downtime as far as workloads are concerned. It supports Share Nothing live migration when you're changing your storage locations. And if you use an SMB share, the migration transfers only the VM running state for even faster completion. It can be completely automated with PowerShell. And the idea is here I've got a 3-node cluster with SMB storage that they're talking to. And I've got a Hyper-V node on the far right-hand side that has a bunch of hosts. I would simply go in and move those Hyper-V hosts, live migrate them off to one of the other nodes. I would then do an in-place upgrade on that particular box to 2012, and then I could go through and make a new cluster and bring those guys over to the new system, and then gradually phase this across the different systems. And I would simply have to make sure that I have access to the storage. In this case, it happens to be an SMB file share mm-hmm. that's being used as the back end. I can talk to and use that as a destination location for my Hyper-V host. So sliding things across, doing an in-place upgrade. Very, very handy to do. And we're trying to make this easier to move from 2012 to 2012 R2.
Yeah, and this is a pretty key scenario in general. As people build these fabric layers and these environments, you know, having to take massive windows of downtime to do upgrades is not acceptable anymore. And so by introducing save state compatibility and one-way upgrade, then you solve that. You can go to 2012 R2 without having to take your existing 2012 services offline. Yes, the individual servers will go offline, but you can move services without having those services go down. That's right. The key.
Moving out of this section and into the security and resilience, high availability and resiliency side of things, obviously, you know, clustering, right?
Yep.
Clustering is still very much an option for being able to have highly available VMs that are up and running that are on the system, as an example. And so with resilient virtual machines, you again have the same level of number of nodes that are supported, number of VMs are supported on those different number of nodes. VMs are automatically going to be able to go over and fail over and restart on different physical hosts when there happens to be a problem. The clustered shared volumes has been improved upon as far as the support that's there, as far as being able to have BitLocker around them sort of stuff. Nothing really has changed majorly from 2012 to 2012 R2 with regards to clustering for the system. In this case, you've got a little thing here that's talking about dynamic quorum configuration. We're basically using node and disk majority. And as long as you have a majority number of votes, then the system is still considered to be up and operational. They can simply move the workloads amongst them. When a particular system goes down, it's able to go through and have the workload balanced across those guys that are still up and running and still continue to function to work. Now, guest clustering, traditionally, this is what we've seen before, where you would have guests that are able to go off and be installed on two different Hyper-V hosts or on the same host cluster that simply are now talking to an iSCSI target, talking with virtual HBAs to a fiber channel SAN, or they can even be talking to SMB storage now from a guest clustering perspective. Now, it has full support for live migration of the guests on cluster nodes while they're running, so you can actually move the node to different areas and have them separate on two different hosts if you wanted to, and has full support for dynamic memory, and has the ability to go through and choose restart priorities, possible and preferred ownership, and things like that. All that sort of stuff is all still the same. There is something that is rather interesting that comes up more so in the next section, which is the concept of you no longer need to have iSCSI or Fiber Channel or SMB storage as your storage.
I need to go off on a tangent, but just go off on a ramble for a minute about this. Guest clustering versus host clustering, and there's a big, I think, misunderstanding in general about when you would use which versus more one versus the other.
Yep.
And there's a big misconception I come across a lot when I go out and I talk to people about Hyper-V and high availability that, you know, if you take a VM and you put a VM on a Hyper-V cluster, you've made the services in the VM highly available. You haven't. Not at all. You've made sure that the workload, that the hardware, the virtual machine is highly available, in that it can move from cluster node to cluster node, but at the end of the day, if you have a situation where a cluster node fails, all the workloads will fail over to another node, but those operating systems are going to need are going to cold reboot. You just yank the power cord, right? And so in practical sense, have a look at my screen for a second. This is my first time I'm going to play with this guy. Our little, by the way, what am I drawing with? I'm drawing with OneNote.
Nice.
You know, where you have your basic, you know, cluster looks like this. See how good this touch interface is right here. Where you have, you know, two nodes, you have some notion of shared storage, right? And then there's some kind of disk storage back here. And you have a VM that's running over here. If something bad happens, the clustering components will fail this over here, but it's got to go through a power cycle.
Right.
That's my little power cycle thing. It looks like an ear.
It does look like an ear.
In order to get up. And so for the services that were running in here, like say maybe this
inside
is,
the VM.
Yeah, maybe this is your exchange environment, they went down when that happened. They're gone.
Ooh. Ooh. You got too close to the edge.
I did. They went down. And so now you've got to deal with that outage, right?
Yep.
With guest clustering, it's a little bit different. With guest clustering,
I just say new page.
Oh, do you? I don't want to leave a mess behind for the next guy, right?
Oh, nice.
With guest clustering, you have same sort of setup, right? Where I've got my Hyper-V host, I've got my shared storage down here, and I've got
another Hyper-V host.
Another Hyper-V host,
so and I've got my hardware VM. Level, the physical
but now
level.
You have two VMs that are configured as a cluster, you know, between themselves. So these guys are actually now clustered.
So that'd be server 2012 or 2012 R2 that has the failover clustering
or
piece installed
2008
on it.
Or 2003 right. or NT or anything,
yeah.
right?
As long as it's supported.
As long as it's supported. But there, it introduces an additional kind of variable of complexity, which is I've now got to present shared storage
to those
two VMs. So how do I go about doing that? Right?
Traditionally, you would use an iSCSI target.
Well, the only option you had in the past was an iSCSI target. So
right.
that meant that somewhere out on the fabric, let's go for kind of draw a really important line here for a second, right here, which is everything above that line is stuff that customers have access to and customers use. Everything below that line is something you manage, right? And so the VMs are the customers. I would have to, in some way, shape, or form, get those customers access to something that's below that line of, you know, this is the, call this the provider boundary and the customer, or the provider area and the customer area. I need to somehow punch a hole in that line mm-hmm. to get them down into something on my fabric that, you know, in SC, there we go. I can't spell iSCSI. That's no,
it's an interesting way that you spelled it.
Oh, good Lord.
It works.
I quit.
I know, right? So basically, you no longer have to break this boundary
well,
with the new way of
right,
doing stuff.
Right. Yeah. With 2012, you had to because iSCSI is the only thing that was supported. With 2008 R2, with 2012, they introduced the notion of not just iSCSI, but you could also do, you know, this could potentially be this could potentially be Fibre Channel, right? So instead mm-hmm. of iSCSI, that could be Fibre Channel, but you're still broaching that line. What they've introduced now with 2008 R with 2012 R2 is the notion of shared VHDX. So rather than having to create something in the fabric down here, where I've got to provision LUNs or storage and touch it, I can have what are essentially file servers down in the fabric. That so here's a series of ooh, that's not still an erase.
Go back to draw.
I'm going to draw my line.
There's the provider, yeah.
So I can create essentially file server endpoints where the servers are things I manage, but they expose UNC paths, right?
Right.
And I can simply create
SMB3 UNC paths.
SMB3 UNC paths.
Right.
And then I can create a VHDX over here, and I can create a cluster using that VHDX file. So everything the customer needs to build the cluster is above the line.
Yep.
And so all I'm doing is I'm providing storage infrastructure to the back end of my servers, presenting VHDs out the front end of my servers, and my client can go ahead and create their own cluster. And I can add 20 VHDs. There's no limits on this, right? I can
yeah.
do, you know, anything I can put on the SCSI bus within the VM. I can do little big VHDXs. I can do small VHDXs. I can do a lot of them. I can do a few of them. And they simply turn up as a shared disk in Cluster Manager. The very first cluster I ever created about 10 or 15 years ago was two SQL servers. There was SQL 7, I think. And I put a SCSI card in, and I put an external SCSI drive on it, and I plugged the two cables in. And it was a shared SCSI drive, but it showed up on both nodes, and I built a cluster. That's what this is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within Hyper-V, what does it look like? I can take a VM. VM's got to be powered off to do it.
Right.
So there's a reboot that's required. But I simply add a hard drive to it, and I'm just going to take the default here for a hard drive, dynamically expanding. And I would need to store that hard drive on a shared location, such as I've got just a file share here. And then
so you just made a new disk, you added it, and you
right.
simply
put it on a file share.
And it's accessible to the guest.
Accessible to the guest. And under advanced features, I go enable virtual hard disk sharing.
Okay.
And then I do this on both cluster nodes. I point them at the same disk. I power them on, and they see the shared VHD. And so there's been changes that happened in 2012 R2 to enable this to happen
mm-hmm.
so that things like SCSI persistent reservations can work in this scenario. Now, this, for some reason, fails. I don't know why. I'm calling this preview bug. Because this should work, but I haven't worked out why this actually fails when I try to do it. So
mm-hmm.
trust me, it will work. I'll bet a lot of people's jobs in Redmond it will work by the time it releases. I know it works now. I've seen it work. I can't work it out. So I'm not going to sweat that too much.
Mm-hmm.
But that's essentially what you do. And the big significant thing that you get out of this is you no longer need to, if you're providing a cloud fabric, to kind of expose what's in this blue area to something that's in this red area directly. You know, because it can become a bit of a management nightmare. You've got an ice, you've got a SAN that you've invested in for iSCSI, and now you've got, you know, 15 different clients that are on 15 different IP spaces that all need to somehow get iSCSI storage off that SAN, and you've got virtual networks going to it, you've got multiple IP addresses going to it, you've got multiple switches and VLANs, it just becomes another nightmare. Now what you can do is simply have a highly available file cluster, expose the UNC paths on the same sort of layer that your VMs are exposed on, and gain access to it. Now, in terms of permissions, right, and this is the other sort of thing to think about, is in terms of permissions, these VMs, there we go, these VMs here, sorry, those hosts, not the VMs, but the actual hosts themselves, are what need permission back to the file share, not the VMs.
Right.
The customer gets no permission to the file share. The hosts need permission to be able to go back and write to that file share. Now, and if you're not at all familiar with the whole idea of, you know, highly available file servers for hosting Hyper-V VHDs, we'll do more on that in the storage section.
Yep.
There's a lot on that in the Jumpstart from last year that you can go to kind of take a look at. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of information in general on that scenario. But the big news is now, in that scenario, I can take two VMs and use a shared VHD file that's living on a file share as the basis of a guest cluster. So I can now offer clustering services to tenants,
mm-hmm.
which in the past a lot of hosted service providers just wouldn't, because they, you know, it was too much of a nightmare to cut a hole in this blue line and plumb them down through. It was just too difficult, expensive, and risky. So now they can offer clustering.
Guest clustering with shared VHDX, as simple it is to be able to go off and add it, obviously is able to be managed and worked with within SCVMM or also through just the regular settings.
It's a big deal for three clicks. Yeah. I mean, it really is.
It's pretty massive. Unrestricted number of VMs can have access to it. Obviously, if you're doing a cluster, 64 VMs and a cluster node mm-hmm. that supports this. VHDX can also be resized as you need to, and it can be located on block-level storage or on a file-based storage that's out there. And it supports both dynamic and fixed VHD files sizes. Just make sure you turn on that shared access checkbox when you're making the new individual disk. Now, from a monitoring perspective, health monitoring of applications can happen inside clustered VMs as well. And basically, when there happens to be a particular service running within the guest VM that goes awry, you're able to go in and basically choose the level. In this case, it's three failures. The cluster service will trigger an event, and then the VM state can choose to move it to a different location if it needs to. That now simply is exposed and be able to be worked with inside your system.
Yep.
Clusterware updating was something that came out in 2012, and the idea of basically having the need to go off and apply patches to your underlying hosts underneath. Clusterware updating reduces your server downtime. Basically, you go in, you have a new particular update that goes up. I like this particular transition. It's kind of funny to see how it goes. The workload goes off, finds the least used server, goes off and moves the workload off, zaps it with an update, and then... and then goes off and updates it.
I've got a picture of a server going, bah!
And it gets an update. The Windows Server Cluster then goes in and juggles over the next workload to the next busy server. It gets zapped and updated, and then the workload moves across and continues on, and then it gets updated. If at any point during this whole process any one of those different systems fail, you can put in safeguards that say roll them back again if you need to. And then eventually the workloads come back, and then it also rebalances them as well. So the idea is that you control the frequency of when this happens, set up to be manual or automatic, and then you choose the endpoint being the Windows Update Server for authorized updates.
Four things.
Yes.
I've seen a bunch of questions. Hey, is it lunchtime in Redmond?
Yes.
Technically, but we got started late, so we're going to go a little bit longer and probably have a shorter break time.
Yes.
We'll be starting again on the top of the hour, but we still got more stuff to do. So we're not done yet. So don't go eat. Just deal with it.
Yeah.
Number two, with the clusterware updating, this is not just for Hyper-V and VMs. This is for anything you cluster, file servers.
Any clustered service.
Any clustered service at all. Scale file servers, SQL servers, Exchange servers. Yeah. It's an orchestration process for clustering in general.
Right.
Number two. VMM does have cluster orchestration for virtual machines in it, which is still the preferred way to do a Hyper-V cluster,
mm-hmm.
Because it can take VM-level stuff into consideration. And then number four, the slide shows Windows Update services, but you can actually do like any kind of update.
It can go hot fixes, queue fixes.
Yeah,
you can also point to file shares for those things. It can be third-party plugins.
And you can write a script. You know, your update could be a script. Like run this, you know, PowerShell script on the node to update it. It doesn't necessarily mean apply a patch. It means make a change.
Yep.
And it'll orchestrate all the roles and just put the change on all of them and then move things back where they were when they're done. So.
Speaking of moving things around, cluster-wise, this again hasn't changed, but simply needs to be aware of that it's possible. The failover priority, affinity, and anti-affinity, basically, where if there's a failure in a particular resource role, like a highly available role, like a VM, when there's a problem, where should it be going to as a priority for who should have ownership of that particular role? You also have the ability to go through and have anti-affinity so that if matter goes to one and antimatter goes to the other one, there's a catastrophic explosion. You can actually move them so they stay on separate hosts. In case one fails over, the other one will move off to the side from an affinity and anti-affinity perspective.
So
this is nothing new. This is
why would you use anti-affinity? Because I have a guest cluster and I don't want both nodes to land on the same physical host.
You
want
to make sure you have diversity with your underlying host.
I want to make sure that you know, that if I have a failover, you know, this particular VM can only go to this half of the cluster, and this one can go to this half of the cluster, so I never wind up in a single point of failure state for the guest cluster. That's one scenario.
Yep. Now, this is another layer of protection and security, which is known as Replica. Replica came out in 2012, the ability to go through and to basically do a scalable replica between two different Hyper-V hosts that can even be in different physical data centers. Provides you the appropriate settings in place between them. And it's inbox and configurable. The difference that we now have with 2012 is that we've now increased the frequency of synchronization that used to be limited to 5 minutes or 15 minutes is now down to 30 seconds of level for the very first one. It gives you a secure replication across the network to the different systems. It's completely agnostic of hardware on either side. This is not a live migration. This is a synchronization that goes on and replicas between two different systems that goes on. It does automatic handling of live migration when required. Simple configuration and management to be able to set it up and be able to work with from a primary site to a secondary site for the way this works. Now, the neat thing that now goes on for the synchronized basis in the background is that once replicated, only changes go across on the specified frequency. And then when there's a particular failure, basically the other guys can then come and pick up the workload. However, you now have the ability with 2012 R2 to do a third level location of an extra layer of resiliency. So picture this now happening. You set up your replication environment, but now you have a DR site that can be offered. So say you're a hosting provider, you're providing replication services from your client to your environment from a disaster recovery perspective, you can actually go and protect yourself as a hosting provider to be able to have a third level or tertiary level of replication that takes place from a Hyper-V replica perspective to a third party site. Very, very cool stuff.
Yeah, and so if you want to, we can show that and just kind of take a quick look at it.
It's pretty simple.
So have a look here. What I've got is just a VM that's running on the host, and I can just go enable replication. And so we go next, and this is a pretty straightforward process. We're going to go to 3. We'll replicate to 3. It'll go verify the configuration, choose protocol. You'd use certificate-based, by the way, if you're going to someone not in your domain.
Yes, not inside your domain environment, certificate-based authentication to be able to.
Yeah, so one of the big scenarios for this tertiary replication is I want to do LAN replica and then WAN replica.
Mm-hmm.
So I want replica within the data center, and then replica to a secondary site, whether it's cloud-based, whether it's another data center, or a provider of the service. So, you know, your first hop might be Kerberos, your second might be certificate-based. Choose the VHDs I'm going to replicate. Frequency, 30 seconds.
You can only go to that low for the first one.
Yep.
The second one cannot go that low.
We're just going to do one latest recovery point, initial replication method sent over the network. A lot of people have often asked me, why would I use external media? Because my VHD is 200 gigs and I don't want to replicate over the WAN link.
Right. Beats the bandwidth of a station wagon full of USB drives driving across the country. When it comes down to it, right? It's that big.
So it next on this and it goes in and creates the replica. And you'll see it sending the replica. If I click over to 3,
and you can also do this from a standalone, non-clustered system into a clustered system. You can do it from clustered system out of the clustered into a
If you're going to go replicate from clustered either into or out of clustered, there is a cluster role called the replica broker,
which basically
that,
is
that
a,
you have to add.
Coordinator.
Yeah, right. And so it has a name, and so you wouldn't replicate to one of the nodes, you'd replicate to the network name of the replica broker.
Right.
Just like when you create a clustered file server, you have a shared file server name, create a clustered with the broker, you have a replica name. Mm-hmm. So this one's receiving changes. And so I can now come in here and I can go, so that's actually, well, I have to wait for this to finish to do the next step. So go ahead and we'll come back to this in just a second.
Yep.
I've got to let this finish.
No problem. When you now take a look at Replica, it was, again, it was inbox of 2012. There's a new functionality that's available on Azure that ties into System Center 2012 R2 Preview that allows you to have what's known as the Azure Hyper-V Recovery Manager, which does not actually do the replication between the two sites, Data Center 1, Data Center 2. What it does is it simply coordinates and talks to the communication channels of your System Center installs on Data Center 1 and System Center installs on Data Center 2, and is able to go through and automate the replication of VMs from within the clouds between those individual sites. Now, this doesn't go through, and again, this does not actually have the replica going up to Azure and then back down again. It simply is able to go through and coordinate the replication between your two data centers. The stuff stays local to those two different environments that's out there, but then it's able to be controlled and managed from within System Center and therefore also take performance data so that when there happens to be a particular outage that it detects based on System Center information, it can initiate the failover as opposed to you having to initiate the failover to your replica copy that's over there. So that's a functionality that's available with the Windows Azure Hyper-V Recovery Manager. And it ties into your System Center 2012 R2 installs that simply allows you to do coordination. So picture your disaster recovery plan. You have to have 25 of your servers up and running on the other side. This is the guy that handles making sure that they're replicated, but then also they start up in the proper order, and they also are up and running on that other side for a level one outage, as an example.
Yep. Cool. Awesome.
So I've got one more slide left to show you, I think, before we take a little bit of a break.
Well,
I've got two more before we go off this.
And
you got a demo.
I've got two more things that I didn't get to show. I got two things that I didn't get to show. I'm waiting for this guy to finish. He'll be done soon. So
I can talk about my last two sections here.
Yeah, go ahead and wrap up. I'll do a couple of quick things, and then we'll take a break.
Now, you already talked about this a bit. This is the enhanced session mode. Enhanced session mode, you alluded to that at the very beginning when you did a connection of the system. The enhanced VM Connect for the richest possible experience in your systems basically gives you audio over the VM Connect environment. It's basically a full remote console capability. You got copy and paste between the host and the guest if you wanted to. It's got smart card redirection. It's got the ability to do remote desktop over VM bus. You do not need to have networking connectivity to be able to hit those guests, to be able to view them. It's enabled for Hyper-V on both server and also in a client as well. And it fully supports live migration of the VMs between the different systems. So enhanced session mode is definitely an improvement to it. Copy and paste back and forth for the host is something I've been waiting for.
Yep.
To be able to do things very nicely, and also smart card integration and other USB plug devices as well.
Cool.
I got one more if you need more time.
No, I'm ready.
Okay, go ahead.
So down on the screen, that initial replica is done. We can go look at it and say, okay, check the health. View help replication health, and we can see, yeah, it's all good and happy. But we can now, and this is the new bit, take that guy and actually extend the replication. And so I choose Extend Replication. This is the exact same process.
That's your third guy, basically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, my third guy. So it was 2012, HV Host 4. Just use Kerberos again. This time you go 5 or 15 minutes.
Right,
you don't get the 30 second. And we just essentially finish it up. And it'll go create the third replica now.
I like how you, again, called out the fact that you could use Kerberos internally, but then you could use certificate-based externally to a hosting provider. Or if you're a hosting provider, you could be using certificate-based for the initial one.
Yep.
If you're going no internal replication, simply me to you as a provider, and then you could protect yourself at the provider level to do I've got that now, I can go and replicate this to my DA site someplace else.
Yep.
And then you choose whatever mechanism you want to at that particular level.
So, cool. And then two more kind of quick things just that are new. So, we have looked at in the past, we've had in the past metering, right? This was something that was introduced in Server 2008 or in Server 2012 RTM, so that you can actually measure things like CPU and network and all that kind of stuff. And I've enabled this. So if I go measure, if I do get VM and just do my DC, and I can measure it. I've already run the command to, I didn't enable it. There we go. So I just go enable VM resource metering.
Right.
Now I can measure it, and it'll give me back a couple of basic bits of data. And you go, well, this is exactly what I had before, right? Well, it is, unless you look a little bit deeper. Because now what we get is disk data.
Oh, okay.
So now we actually have measurement based on IOPS, latency, and aggregated data read and data written. Mm-hmm. So in the past, the only disk measurement you had was how big the VHD is. Mm-hmm. Now you can actually, because we can also do QoS and IOPS, we can now actually calculate how many IOPS a given VM is running over a period of time, and then use that to figure out, you know, how much we charge a person for running that VM.
Okay.
It's also a phenomenal troubleshooting tool because you can now go, well, geez, the server's running slow.
You know,
let's run it for an hour
and
let's see which VMs are generating the most IOPS without having to go perfmonning everything, right? So it's kind of a, you know, I call it like a poor man's perfmon, if you would. But I've used this to, you know, so I got a bunch of running VMs and which one's using the disk the most, just measure the IOPS on it and over an hour and see which one's generating the most IOPS, and that'll tell you. Phenomenal improvement here for 2012 R2. And then the final one, also a PowerShell thing. If you've ever done really, really custom permissions in Hyper-V, my brain's starting to shut off, you had to use Authorization Manager.
Yep.
That's gone. That's been depreciated or deprecated, whatever the word is. It's gone now. It doesn't exist. So how do you do console-only permissions? And we have seen this question come up mainly from hosters. They want to give a customer access to console to do self-diagnosis, and they'd use ASMAN to create custom roles and custom permissions for that. That's gone. You now have three choices. You have full-on server admin, which we wouldn't want to do. You have Hyper-V admin, which is what your Hyper-V administrators might be, which is a group-level permission, a local group-level permission. They still exist. That was introduced in 2012. And you would do ASMAN for everything else. Now, they've dropped all the ASMAN stuff. You can no longer do custom, highly custom permission sets. And you now have one PowerShell command, which is called grant VM connect access, which is this guy right here, grant VM connect access. And that will grant a user or a group access to view and interact with the console, but do nothing else. And so
they can change VM settings, they can go in and...
No, they can't. No settings.
The console.
See the console. This is the equivalent of RDP, if you would. Right? You have RDP access to the guest, but you can't configure the server, so that's it. So all those are gone. And there's been a little bit of pushback I've heard from time to time, but at the end of the day, 99.99999% of all people that did the ASMAN stuff, this is all they did anyway, which is they use it for console access. They weren't giving customers VM change permissions, snapshots, any of that stuff. It was just you can interact with the console or Hyper-V. That's how you get into your workload. And everything else we control, which is an administrator-level permission for Hyper-V anyway. So if you've come across that reference to ASMAN being gone, this is the replacement PowerShell.
Nice. The last slide I wanted to show you is one thing that can come up as being interesting, mostly so in the hosting space, is automatic virtual machine activation. The idea of basically being able to worry about if you have a data center install of server 2012 R2 that's being used as your Hyper-V host, you have a whole whack of different VMs that have to go off and be activated in some way, shape, or form. If you're using this, you now have the ability to go through and basically use a key on that particular host that will be used to license that guy and activate that guy, but then your individual VM guests, when they use a particular key, can be activated so long as the host is activated on the system. So VMs basically are activated on startup. You're able to do reporting and tracking that's built into it. The VMs in a remote location with or without internet connectivity can now also be activated as well because that host has been activated once. It works also with VM migration as well. Yeah. You've got a generic activation key that's used that activates against valid activated 2012 Hyper-V host license.
Yeah. And this is obviously a really big one for hosters, right?
Because it's that whole separation of customer versus
Because if you provider, if you wanted to activate VMs, you had to create network connectivity with a KMS, or you had to punch in a bunch of keys, none of which were desirable because the keys were exposed.
Right.
So it was either the complexity of network with KMS, or punching a key and have the key potentially be ripped out by assorted evil things. Mm-hmm. Now, if you drop the VM on the activated data center server, the VM's activated. When you take the VM off, it's no longer activated. It's just, it's an inherited property. There's no key in the VM. Mm-hmm. So, yay for this.
Yes, definitely. So with that, my friend, I think that we are at the point where we were trying to be at. We're going to be taking a little bit of a break. We saw a whole whack of different stuff. And as you mentioned, there's a wide variety of sessions available on channelline.msdn.com/events/tech@North America, or as you mentioned, northamerica.mstech.com. That'll work as well. It gets you to recorded content from a whole variety of different speakers talking about and much more in depth to what we were talking about here. With regards to virtualization, although we covered a pretty big gamut
in an hour and a half. There's a lot in here, yeah.
Definitely a lot of stuff. Resource-wise as well, you want to go off and download Windows Server 2012 R2 Preview, aka.ms/ws2012r2. You want to go off and get System Center 2012 R2 as well, aka.ms/sc2012r2. And as we've been mentioning throughout this individual session, we're not going into depth on SCVMM. We're talking about it as a fabric management piece throughout this particular session today, and also through sessions tomorrow as well. For the remainder of sessions, if you want more detailed ones, there is a jumpstart on July 15th, aka.ms/scr2js. It's a one-dayer just on the new 2012 R2 System Center environment
that's
out there. With that, my friend, I'm going to say, we need a break. We're going to take a break, a brief break. We'll be back at the top of the hour, wherever that hour happens to be for you. And we'll be coming back with networking, I do believe.
Networking is, I believe, is what's next. So, cool.
Thanks, man. Cheers.
Do it. We'll see you guys in a little bit.